You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. There have been a lot of shipwrecks in the course of human history, some famous, many more forgotten. Some of those wrecks, like the Lusitania, played a part in world history. Here in the Midwest, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald lives on in legend and song. But the Titanic looms large over the history of shipwrecks. In his new book, our next guest shares the story not just of the Titanic, but of the people who have obsessed over it, quested to find its remains, to bring them back up to the surface, even claimed to own the wreck. We're listening back to our conversation with him now, and you can get in touch by emailing ideas@wpr.org. Are you interested in shipwrecks? Just shipwreck curious? Do you have a wreck that's really captured your imagination? If you dive, have you ever gotten to see one up close? Are there stories that you hope could still be discovered? Let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Stone is an author on science and adventure and a senior editor for National Geographic. He's a former White House correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. His latest book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. We talked to him about it this summer. Here's a listen. Will you start off with a little quiz you give people? I know the answer already. I cheated. I read the book. You ask people how many shipwrecks they think there are out there in the seas. And I think I can guarantee anybody who's coming up with a number is probably too low. Can you give us a sense of the scope of shipwrecks?
Yeah, I've asked this question to hundreds of people over the past few years, and everyone is wrong. When we think of how many shipwrecks there are in the world, we usually think of the big ones, the Titanic, the Lusitania, as you mentioned. But we forget that for centuries, this is how people transported themselves and goods all over the world. And so the number, according to UNESCO, about 10 years ago, is actually 3 million shipwrecks in the oceans, lakes, and rivers all over the world.
Now, the Titanic, as you mentioned, gets a lot of the attention. And it wasn't, you write, the biggest or the deadliest shipwreck of all time. So what is it about the wreck of the Titanic that made it such a big thing that we're still talking about it to this day?
Well, you're right. There's almost nothing unique about the Titanic. I mean, ships had been built big before. There were a lot of ships for rich people that ferried people across the Atlantic. Even iceberg strikes were very common in the 1880s and 90s. They had actually started to decline around the time of the Titanic. So I kind of narrowed down on this theory that the reason the Titanic has so much lasting staying cultural power is this weird quirk of a ratio of numbers. We all know that about 1,500 people died on the Titanic, but also about 700 people lived. And those 700 were mostly young women and children who ended up living another 50, 60, 70 years telling and retelling the stories of that night. And storytelling is what keeps kind of the cultural lore of any event alive. And in that case, kept the Titanic alive enough to be reinvented in movies, books, and museum exhibits for more than a century.
Now, your book is not just about the Titanic, but about the people who've gotten obsessed with it over the years. Can we throw you in with that category? Was there something that just like got you so interested, obsessed with hearing these stories?
I have resisted being a shipwreck obsessive, but I think I am. I love these wrecks. There's so many around the world. I fixated on the Titanic since I was a boy, as most young people do. It's just a great story. I did my science project when I was in first grade on floating and sinking and figuring out why some things float and why they don't. I frankly still struggle to understand, you know, the viscosity of materials and how ships are built. It's an endless world of mystery and intrigue, especially when you get to old ships and wrecks carrying buried treasure and you know, races for lost shipwrecks. It really gets fascinating.
Talking to Daniel Stone, his new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in if you share his curiosity about the Titanic and other shipwrecks. If you have a question to share, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, of course, I'd heard about the Titanic. I didn't really know about this world of people who, over the years, tried to find it. And once it was found, tried to bring it up. You talked to some of the people. Give us a sense of the scope, from the like amateurs and maybe weirdos, we might say, to the professionals, mm-hmm. and all points in between. There's a lot of people who have done this stuff.
Yeah, almost immediately after the Titanic sank, there was this effort to try to find it and salvage it, raise it up. And, you know, for people in the early 20th century who had no experience doing this, this didn't seem that outlandish, right? There was one guy named Charles Smith in 1914, 2 years after the Titanic sank, who said, I'm just going to go to the wreck site, or I'm going to go to the site where it went down. I'm going to drop a few electromagnets in the water. They're going to attract themselves to the ship. They're going to attach themselves, and then we'll just pull them up as though it would be that easy. And the 20th century is filled with people like Charles Smith who start to imagine this goal. They think it's fascinating. They think there's a lot of fame and fortune to be gained for whoever finds and raises the Titanic. And they keep getting defeated. They have these wild plans of, you know, finding the ship and putting ping pong balls in the ship or foam that'll float it to the surface. And they keep getting pushed back, mostly because they're amateurs. You know, ship salvage is a real industry, but for people who just love wrecks, they don't have the equipment, the knowledge, and the experience really to pull up a ship, let alone one as big as the Titanic, 2.5 miles deep.
Now, you had kind of an obsession trying to meet the man who owned the wreck of the Titanic, or at least told the world that he owned it. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, this is a funny story of the Titanic, and this man, his name's Doug Woolley, is the central character of my book, very colorful character, who basically decides as a young boy in the 1940s that he wants to own the Titanic that's underwater. And he goes through this elaborate legal process when he becomes a young man, and he puts ads in newspapers, and eventually he gets to a point where nobody objects. You know, the wreck is underwater. Nobody knows where it is. No one's going to fight him on it. And so he spends most of the 60s, 70s, and 1980s claiming that he owns the wreck. And he plans to go find it. He plans to corral a team together to go salvage it. And this is written up in newspapers all over the world, in every country, as this man who owns the wreck. And Doug Woolley is still alive. He's 86, lives in England. I went to visit him. He still thinks it's possible. And I kind of realized that this was the North Star of his life. And the Titanic was something he really wanted to go save. But at almost every point of his life, the Titanic kept reinventing Doug Woolley and saving his life instead.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hello.
Hi, this is a great topic. I have my 9-year-old son has been obsessed with the Titanic for at least 2 years. He has a poster and Legos with a really awesome Titanic ship. There's so many unbelievable stories about that tragedy. I don't know if they're actually true. Like one was there was a, you know, sailor who was told at the last minute not to go, but he had the key to the room where the lookout people would have normally been able to see the iceberg with the binoculars, but the room was locked with the binoculars that they normally would have used. And that's why they didn't see it sooner. And my son has these I Survived book series about natural or historical tragedies that occur throughout the world. And this whole thing, he's been a huge history buff, but the Titanic really was the thing that jump-started his interest in history.
Interesting, Brian. A couple of things there, Daniel. First of all, that legend. There are lots of legends about the Titanic. You were just talking about Doug Woolley. He had a family legend that he had a couple of relatives who, at the last minute, had a premonition that something bad was going to happen, didn't get on the ship. I don't think that was confirmed. There's a lot of these stories out there.
Yeah, almost endless stories. I haven't heard that specific one about the binoculars. It sounds like something that would have happened aboard the Titanic. But to your caller's point, I mean, the amount of folklore and urban legends that sometimes are facts, sometimes not, but inspire this next generation. I mean, a 9-year-old today was not even alive at the 100th anniversary of the Titanic and is still deeply inspired. That's beautiful and kind of speaks to his sense of history and putting himself in its place.
Brian, thanks for that call. We're talking to National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone. His new book is called Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about shipwrecks? Why ships sink? What happens when they do? Are you personally curious, like our caller's kid was, about shipwrecks? Is there one that intrigues you in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with National Geographic senior editor Daniel Stone about his new book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can join in with your questions, your own shipwreck curiosities, Titanic or otherwise, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I was intrigued many years ago after reading a book about the fact that gold heavily laden on ships was, of course, very highly prized, and there wasn't really a good way to get it from California during the gold rush to the New York banks. The only way that it could be shipped was to go around the tip of South America and then up, all the way up the coastline, all the way to New York, and that the building of the Panama Canal was really because of the ease of transportation of gold. And I thought you would be interested in that because so many ships laden heavily with gold have been found all along the South American coastline on the east and west sides, and, of course, along the whole eastern seaboard. The building of the Panama Canal was so important for the transportation of gold.
Interesting. Nancy, thanks a lot for the call. And then you reference there's a lot of gold, or has been over the years, from not just the California gold rush, but from the Spanish galleons taking gold across one ocean or another.
Yeah, especially, Rob, down by the coast of Florida is often called the Treasure Coast, from those specific two eras, the gold rush and one very large wreck that sank there in 1857 called the SS Central America, often called the Ship of Gold. And then all of the Spanish ships that were in Central and South America during the period of colonization, you know, getting and pilfering as much as they could, and they'd bring that treasure up along the coast of Florida and often get caught in storms. And so one of the most valuable shipwrecks ever found, the Nuestra Señora de Atocha, went down right around Florida. It was found in the 1970s with several hundred million dollars of gold on board. And it's believed there's many galleons still out there, many in those waters.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Cody joins us now in Chautauqua. Cody, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Cody?
So I was just curious, when it comes to shipwrecks, when a ship goes down, is it like a free-for-all for whoever wants to go explore it can go down there and maybe grab stuff or see what's going on with it? Or are there laws that prohibit people from going there and like disrupting it from where its resting place is? Because not only with the Titanic, but another one that I'm familiar with and I follow a lot with the history of is the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I was just curious as to if people are not allowed to bother with it where it sits at the bottom of the lake or the ocean floor.
Cody, thanks a lot for that call. You wrote something to the effect of, Dan, the most important piece of technology for somebody looking for shipwrecks is a really good legal team.
Exactly. And this is a great question from Cody that has a kind of a long answer. I'll give a short one, which is ships are subject to very weird legal parameters, right? Ships can be built in one country, sail to another country, be carrying goods from a third country, holding people of different citizenships and nationalities. So the jurisdiction over a ship when it goes down can get very complicated very quickly. The Edmund Fitzgerald, on account of being fairly contained within the U.S. In the Great Lakes, is kind of a no-brainer and very easy. But when a ship like the Titanic goes down, or another one that's holding gold, you know, in the middle of the ocean, you often see these big races among countries to prove that they had claim over the ship and the contents of it. But often these things get very legally thorny, and the best way to go for a ship is to choose one that's old, because when it's old, the insurers, the owners, the passengers, the families, everyone has mostly died. And those are the ships that are most often given or granted to the people who find them.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Stone, author of the new book, Sinkable, Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Margaret joins us now in Franklin. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Margaret?
Well, it's such a wonderful show. I'm so excited because my grandson has been so interested in the Titanic, and just as the previous gentleman called and said his son was, he's been reading all the I Survived books, and I don't know where he got the interest from, but he is going on vacation with his family down to Tennessee, and from what they're telling me, there is a museum down there regarding the sinking and everything about the Titanic. So that sounded really interesting. He has to go see it. And I read a book some years ago called The Christmas Tree Ship, about the ship that used to haul Christmas trees from up north, Lake Michigan shore, down to Chicago in the 1800s. So people down there could have Christmas trees, live Christmas trees. And it sunk off of two rivers.
Yeah. Margaret, thanks for the call. We've talked about the Christmas tree ship on the show in the past. She mentioned that museum in Tennessee. A few different places have built, mostly on dry land, replicas of some or all of the Titanic, Dan.
Yeah, in Tennessee, actually in Pigeon Forge, there is a half-scale replica of the half of the Titanic, which is great to visit, especially for young people to see the ship up close. There's also one in Branson, Missouri. The first full-scale replica of the full Titanic is currently being built in a province in western China at the moment. One thing I learned while reading and learning about the Titanic is that the Titanic story is especially big in China for reasons I still don't know. But the movies, all of the James Cameron movie and many of the movies that have been made about the Titanic do especially well in China. And they love this story there and can't get enough.
Thanks for the call, Margaret. PJ joins us now in Appleton. PJ, hi.
Hi. Back in the 70s, when I was in high school, my brother was fireman, oiler, water tender, shipping out of the Merchant Marine and to Russia, a lot of different places. But at one point, he was shipping out on ore boats in the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, at that same time, they came out with that song that you mentioned the boat and the ship and the song, and my mama couldn't listen to it. We'd have to turn the radio off when that one came on.
PJ, thanks so much for sharing that. And that brings me to something I wanted to bring up, Dan, that I took away from your book. You know, nowadays we might go on a cruise on a ship for fun. Our biggest worry might be our blood sugar from the sweet drinks on it or whatever. Through most of history, up to pretty recently, going to sea is really dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, this was a extremely deadly way to travel, and really the only way to travel to another country for almost all of human history. And we have stories of people who made it across oceans, right? Like Columbus or Da Gama. But we forget the many, many millions of people who died on ships. And so it's only recently, and it's kind of a sign of the technology of our modern era, that when we think of relaxing or having a vacation, we think of going on large boats, in some cases through the same waters where some of the biggest shipwreck accidents have been through history. And we don't really think much of it. And I will say that that's, you know, kind of a triumph of technology. And it's also, it doesn't happen very often that we see these accidents anymore. We still have accidents of cruise ships and container ships much less often and much less deadly.
Now, here's you also look into the sort of the physics and mechanics of a shipwreck. And here's something that struck me, right? I think of a ship like the Titanic slowly settling down to the ocean floor. Wrong. Like 30 mile per hour impact. Did I read that right?
Yeah. Yeah. The Titanic split in half on the surface, and the bow fell a lot faster, almost like a missile, 30 miles an hour. They scientists have figured this out by looking at the current wreck site and reverse engineering how everything got where it was. But yeah, once a ship, which is, of course, lighter than the water it displaces, that's what helps it float. Once it takes on water, it becomes heavier, and it can become a lot heavier than the water. And when it has a trajectory of 2 miles or more, like the Titanic to sink, its terminal velocity could be as high as 30 or even more miles per hour.
All right, I got to ask, after spending years pursuing the stories of shipwrecks, are you more or less likely to want to spend time on a boat at sea?
Oh, I get horribly, horribly seasick. I can't even be on a kayak or canoe. And one of my great fears of writing this book is, you know, to become a shipwreck expert and invited on cruises to talk about it and just, you know, reveal my extreme antipathy to ships. I love ships. I just can't handle being on them.
No offense. If I operate a cruise ship line, I'm probably not going to invite the shipwreck author.
There you go. Exactly.
Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Daniel Stone is an author on science and adventure, senior editor for National Geographic. Talk to him in August about his book, Sinkable: Obsession, the Deep Sea, and the Shipwreck of the Titanic. You can still let us know what shipwreck you're most curious about, or if there's a story that you found super interesting, or if you've dived down and explored one yourself. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, polarization and extreme politics are on the rise. But Amanda Ripley is back with us to say we can still fix things, and we've only barely started to try. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Making our own pasta may sound complicated to me, but a cookbook author tells us it can be easier and more delicious than we think. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, seasonal affective disorder mostly affects people in the fall and winter months. A clinical psychologist joins the show to talk about the disorder and what you can do if you begin to experience it with the changing season. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, with early voting well underway, less than a week now until the last day of the election, we'll get a final midterm preview from longtime politics watcher Craig Gilbert. First, new seasons bring about change for everyone, but for some people, the change of seasons can lead to a form of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. The disorder is most common in fall and winter, which is why it's sometimes called winter depression. About 5% of Americans deal with seasonal affective disorder. Many more have milder seasonal symptoms. No surprise, it's more common in northern parts of the country where the days get shorter. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Am I talking about you? Have you experienced seasonal affective disorder before? Do you feel like your mood tends to change during a new season, during the colder months with more darkness here in Wisconsin? What time of year do you feel happiest or feel some of these symptoms? Have you found ways to deal with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dr. Shyla Mergain is a distinguished psychologist at UW Health. Dr. Mergain, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Can you talk about some of the particulars of seasonal affective disorder? How do we diagnose that?
This is such a timely conversation with daylight savings time this weekend and the colder weather quickly approaching. And seasonal affective disorder is a recurrent form of depression that occurs seasonally, usually in the winter months, although occasionally it can happen in the summer, although that's quite rare. Symptoms of SAD, seasonal affective disorder, or SAD, include feeling down most of the day, nearly every day, loss of interest or pleasure in things that a person typically enjoys, significant fatigue, concentration problems, weight and sleep disturbance, and often a sense of hopelessness or helplessness. And what we're looking for when we're diagnosing seasonal affective disorder or SAD is that seasonal pattern and also the frequency and intensity of symptoms. So we're not looking for just one day where you feel kind of down, but more of a persistent pattern that it's occurring most of the day, nearly every day for at least 2 weeks, and also looking at the intensity and impact that we're looking at the symptoms causing significant distress or impacting various areas of functioning.
A lot of those symptoms you mentioned, I do associate with depression in general. How much overlap is there between seasonal affective disorder and depression as it's usually thought of?
Yeah, significant seasonal affective disorder is just a specifier of a major depressive episode or major depressive disorder. So the episode is occurring during that that season, typically the winter months. So it's often that is why there is that commonality.
Are there things in common for people who might feel a little bit of, you know, winter blah, but it's not full on seasonal affective disorder, and people who are feeling more seriously? Are there things that either of those groups of people can do that might help them a little bit?
Absolutely. While not everyone might experience seasonal affective disorder, many people are vulnerable to a milder form, what is often referred to as the winter blues. Just living here in Wisconsin, we know we're going to be going into that season where it's cold and dark, it's snowy and slippery, and certainly some of the stressors that are lingering with the pandemic can also make people vulnerable to just lower moods. So we really want to safeguard our mental health. And there are protective factors that can really improve our mood so that we, one, don't fall into a clinical depression, but two, that we're also not struggling with some of that blah mood, that lethargy, that lack of motivation. Also, many people during the holidays are vulnerable to negative health habits. So I think it's time to really work on that winter survival kit so we can stay healthy and happy this time of year.
Talking to Dr. Shyla Mergane from UW Health, psychologist there, looking at seasonal affective disorder. You can join in with your questions, maybe your experiences with SAD, seasonal affective disorder, maybe something you found that helps you or someone you know. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. All right, Dr. Mergane, let's get into some of those protective things that you just mentioned. And I know one thing that could happen in winter is if we're not getting outside as much, one thing we may not also be doing is hanging out with other people as much. How important is that social and community connection?
Thank you for mentioning those. When I think about a winter survival toolkit, I think about six different tools that really can be instrumental in safeguarding your overall well-being. And you're speaking to one of just staying connected. Winter can bring decreased socialization or social isolation. And we know that staying socially connected is one of those protective factors against developing depression. So, we really want to make staying socially connected a priority to maintain our well-being in a positive mood. So as we go into these colder, darker months, just thinking about a plan for staying in communication with those people who are helpful, who are important, who you love and care about. Could be a gathering in person, but we certainly have a lot of technology of even just doing a virtual call with somebody, or even just reaching out via text, or even just, as you mentioned, doing some exercise together. So doing an activity together can really be important so we don't get so isolated and feel so alone. And there's nothing like when we're in a bad mood, there's nothing like being around somebody who cares about you, who's a positive influence, to really boost that overall sense, giving you energy, giving you that motivation, giving you that perspective. So also reaching out to people if you are struggling to talk about it, to get that kind of support, can really be a safety net during these darker months ahead.
I want to key in on one word you use, and that's to have a plan to stay connected. Because I know if somebody's feeling depressed in the moment, it may be hard to spontaneously reach out and try to set something up with somebody. But if we get ahead of things, schedule things in advance, a weekly meetup or whatever it might be, that maybe we're going to stick to that.
Absolutely, right, whether it's a regular thing that we're doing and even just encouraging people to check in on you. Hey, can you check in on me in a couple weeks can be good. And sometimes when we're depressed or in that place of the winter blues, we get really inward focused. So another way of staying connected is just reaching out to somebody who might be struggling. It could be, even anonymously, like doing some random act of kindness of paying for somebody in line their coffee, the car behind you. I mean, there is research that random act of kindness can boost our mood as well. So, there's nothing like being of service, expressing that sense of purpose and those core values through doing something kind for somebody else. And that just gets us out of our inner self into the larger community and reminds us that we're not alone and that we still can make a difference. We have that purpose. And we can be of help.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hi. Well, I have seasonal affective disorder, and I've used the light box But one thing I think that's really helped me is I take extra vitamin D in the winter, the sunshine vitamin.
Mm-hmm. And it really
seems to help me.
Excellent. Kay, thank you so much for calling in and sharing both of those. Okay, a couple things there, Shyla. First of all, the vitamin D, is that, whether it's a supplement or in our food, is that something that's going to help?
I love it. Kay, thank you for sharing two really important tools in our winter survival toolkit. Vitamin D3, really encourage people to consume foods rich in vitamin D3 to counter the lack of sun exposure. So fish and mushrooms are great sources of vitamin D3. And for many people, vitamin D3 supplements are really important. So speak with your physician to find out if a supplement would be right for you, as well as the recommended dosage.
And exposing ourselves to more light, Kay mentioned, that might be getting out in the limited sunlight, or she mentioned light boxes.
Yeah, because the shortened daylight hours during fall and winter can disrupt the natural circadian rhythms. Exposure to light can be beneficial. And in two ways, as you're mentioning, there is a special light therapy box that has a full spectrum light bulb. And the recommendation is to sit in front of it for 30 minutes a day to counteract the effects of seasonal affective disorder. You always want to speak with your physician before using that kind of light therapy box. But also, as you mentioned, just getting outside on those sunny days, increasing that time when weather allows outside, and also letting some natural light in. One of the best things to do in the morning is to open up the curtains, eat your breakfast in front of the window, read the newspaper in front of the window, listen to Wisconsin Public Radio in front of a window. So you're letting that natural light in, and that just helps balance those natural circadian rhythms of that sleep wake cycle, just to keep the system in balance.
Okay, thanks for calling. We're talking to Dr. Shyla Merghain, distinguished psychologist at UW Health, looking at seasonal affective disorder. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this before? Are you worried about it coming into this winter season? Have you found solutions yourself? Do you have questions for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Shyla Merghain, distinguished psychologist at UW Health, with us today to talk about seasonal affective disorder and how to treat it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your own experience, maybe a solution you found, or a question for our guest. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Josie joins us now in Monona. Josie, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Josie?
We've been doing this since my oldest was a baby, so almost 9 years now. The conservatory at the Olbrich Botanical Gardens right over here in Madison are fantastic, especially on those really cold, like it's too cold to go outside, but sunny days. Like you feel like you're, you know, in a summer somewhere tropical, and it really brings up your mood. We've done that with friends, and like I said, he's 9 now. We've done that since he was a baby, so it really helps a ton.
Fantastic, Josie. Thanks for sharing that. Shyla, what do you think?
I just love that. I was just there last week, Josie, with my little daughter, and saying, I have to come here in the middle of winter. I think that's such a great idea. And it speaks to the larger tool when we think about that winter survival toolkit of just self-care. There can be like a little outing that you look forward to and get excited about. That's a tradition, like going to Olbrich Garden and in that inner conservancy. But, you know, it could be anything. We have the holidays coming up, and there may be some traditions that you can get excited about. Or maybe there's just a new skill, or even a staycation, taking a day off from work, or if you're not working, just a Saturday, make it like a little adventure, just discovering something new in your community. And we find that we have those enjoyable activities or something that we're planning and preparing to look forward to that actually can boost mood, and we're really cultivating our joy. Oftentimes this time time of year can be quite stressful with the overall environment in our country and the holidays, and also working on some stress management skills that we don't want to get so consumed by the stress that we lose track of what's most important. And so when we think about self-care, eating nutritious foods, watching alcohol intake, making sure you're sleeping, having those good healthy routines, even practicing some mindfulness, using your senses of just what delights your senses in this moment to really be here now. All of that, I think, are some of those kind of protective factors to really stabilize our mood.
And not everybody, thanks for that call. Not everybody has a nice botanical garden with a conservatory nearby. How about the value of finding ways, even when the weather isn't great, to get outside?
Yeah, thank you. You know, we in Wisconsin, we are so blessed with our state parks, county parks, little areas for nature, and just to get outside on those warmer days. Or I think there's nothing like good winter gear to help you stay active during the during even the colder, snowier, icier days. And also thinking about a winter sport. Usually during the winter, we start to get lethargic and want to kind of hibernate, like the bears do in the cave of our home. And we find that that is not helpful long-term. Our winters last too long. And so, you know, if you can get out to a winter sport like hiking, skiing, or snowshoeing, or maybe joining a local gym, or even just going to some of our stores. And I've had people do that, going to one of the larger stores or the mall and even get permission from the store owner to do some walking. keep going back up and down those aisles. Motion is really important to keep things fluid in our system. And, you know, so much research shows that exercise, aerobic exercise, like, for example, walking at a brisk pace for at least 3 times a week can be as beneficial as medication for mild to moderate forms of depression. So just to plan ahead of time, this time, how can I stay active? And some people are out of shape, Rob, and they feel kind of intimidated by going to a big gym. So I always say start small. Even 5 minutes can make a difference. 5 minutes of aerobic exercise, and even thinking about doing some resistance training as well, can really boost your mood and give you a pep in your step.
So a lot of great tools in the toolkit, Dr. Morgain. What is the line, though, where somebody should say, you know what, this is a little beyond these things helping me? When should people be thinking about getting some help for dealing with seasonal affective disorder?
Absolutely. I think that's such a great question and one to consider. And it's for yourself, but also if you see a loved one who's really struggling, maybe recommending that for them. So if those symptoms of seasonal affective disorder are persisting, they're not subsiding, if they're causing distress or impairment, for example, if you're having trouble getting out of bed, if you find that it's causing it's really hurting your relationships, or maybe you're suffering at work, don't hesitate to seek professional help. I think a real takeaway is early intervention helps people recover faster. For many people, medication management can be really useful, taking medication, antidepressant medication, especially during the winter months. And then therapy, you know, we live in a time where there's a lot of virtual treatments. So talk therapy can be quite useful as well, learning additional strategies like working with negative thinking and trying to create more balanced, thinking, more helpful thinking, more coping thinking. That is something, for example, therapy can address. Sometimes dealing with those significant stressors that are tugging at your mood. So talking to your physician, your primary care physician, to find the most appropriate treatment for you, and don't hesitate to reach out for help. And also encourage loved ones to reach out for help as well. Don't be afraid to express, hey, I'm noticing you're struggling. You know, I recommend that you get some medical treatment for this. Can really do wonders. And certainly if a person is suicidal, that, you know, immediately we want help. We want to, there's a suicide hotline we can call, talking to your physician, going to the emergency room, or calling 911. We want to really address that immediately.
Dr. Morgain, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
That's Dr. Shyla Morgain, distinguished psychologist at UW Health. She joined us today to talk about seasonal affective disorder and what you need to know before we head into the colder months with shorter days. inflation is an ongoing concern around most of the world and here in the U.S., as we've talked about on the show lately. In closely divided Wisconsin, it's top of mind for many voters who are getting ready to cast their ballots next week. Bridget Bowden reports.
Carol Henning and her husband recently retired and moved back to Wisconsin to be close to their daughter in Waukesha.
And so we are now those people who are living on a fixed income.
While she says they aren't in any financial danger right now, they have made adjustments at the grocery store, where costs are up 13% from last year.
And we are big grillers, so the meat market is one of our favorite places to be. Having watched some of those prices of things as simple as chicken breast just skyrocket, those were kind of go-to, safe, easy, inexpensive things.
Henning considers herself a Republican, but sometimes votes for Democrats. She hasn't decided who she'll vote for governor or U.S. senator yet, but she says the economy is her number one issue. And she's not alone. Milwaukee resident Amon Seyavong, an independent voter who often votes for Democrats, says he thinks the economy is the most important issue because it affects everyone.
Even though people will say, you know, people will talk about abortion or crime, I think you are not affected by that on a daily basis. But when you have to go and pay, you know, 10-20% more for your gas, that's something that affects you directly.
Inflation is an increase in prices that happens when demand exceeds supply. It's happening at high levels in the U.S. and around the world, thanks mostly to disruptions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and the war in Ukraine, according to economists. In the latest Marquette University Law School poll released Wednesday, 68% of respondents said they were very concerned about inflation, the most of any issue. And so the candidates for statewide office are talking about it, like in the race for U.S. Senate between Republican Senator Ron Johnson.
Inflation is the Democrats' tax on the middle class.
And Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes.
Both senators couldn't tell you the cost of a gallon of milk.
And in the race for governor between Democratic Governor Tony Evers.
Folks, that's a problem. That's why I have a plan to cap prescription drug prices.
And Republican Tim Michaels.
Tim Michaels, I've got a blueprint to grow jobs and stop the outrageous spending that got us into this mess.
But according to University of Michigan labor economist Don Grimes, there are only so many ways to address inflation. One is to reduce demand. In other words, make people want to buy less. You can do that, Grimes says, by raising taxes. But in an election year, politicians don't want to talk about that.
And I wouldn't hold my breath after the election either.
The other way, which has already happened a few times this year, is through an interest rate hike from the nation's powerful central bank, the Federal Reserve. Grimes says that should slow inflation, but will likely cause other economic consequences.
I mean, I have no doubt in my mind that the Federal Reserve will bring down inflation. The problem is that they sort of have a blunt tool to do that, where they increase interest rates, and it tends to cause a recession frequently.
Regardless of what actually happens with the economy in the coming months, Grimes expects it will influence voters. He says historically, when people perceive the economy as bad, they punish the party in power. And that's why he thinks this will be a Republican year.
You know, politicians get too much credit when things are going well, and they get too much blame when things are going bad. But, that's the job they took.
But Grimes says there's a disconnect between what voters feel about the economy and what politicians can actually change. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, veteran journalist Craig Gilbert says we're in unusual territory with closely matched races for Wisconsin governor and Senate in the same cycle. We'll get a home stretch midterm preview. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.